Welcome back to The Hopeless Romantic. As always, I am Austin Chant.
I'm Amanda Jean.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Jim Grimsley. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I am Jim Grimsley.
Jim Grimsley is a Lambda Award-winning novelist and playwright, and most recently the author of How I Shed My Skin, Unlearning the Racist Lessons of a Southern Childhood, a memoir, that was published in 2015. And previously, he's authored a number of books and plays, many of which were very influential on our own Amanda Jean.
Yes, it's true. I, as a sad queer teenager, was doing my utmost to find any book that spoke to my sad queer experience. I did a whole bunch of reading straight out the gate. I did a lot of memoir reading, anthology reading, nonfiction reading. And then I picked up Dream Boy, and it ruined my life. I think it ruins everyone's life who's read it, which actually I've done a sampling of my friends who are also queer and generally in my age range, and it's entirely like consistent. Pretty much everybody was like, yeah, Dream Boy, it shattered me as a person.
Well, that's actually rather nice to hear.
See, I figured that someone who wrote that and wrote Boulevard and Comfort and Joy and, you know, the list goes on would appreciate a good shattering. So
I can remember when I first published Dream Boy, it was my second novel in this country. I was at a book festival and a lady came up to me. My first novel was also kind of shattering, Winter Birds. Yeah. And she picked up a copy of Dream Boy and she looked at me and she got this kind of sad look on her face and she said, is this book? And then she paused because she had an awkward question to ask. And I said, yes, ma'am, this book is just as depressing as the last book was.
You're not wrong. I would argue that Winter Birds is about 10 times as depressing as Dream Boy. I read Winter Birds on a car trip with my family headed to Canada. And at one point I was so verklempt that I was like, I think I'm going to throw this book out of the window, but then I wouldn't be able to finish it.
I've heard that before, actually, not the family vacation part.
It was brutal. And you know what was funny is I read Winter Birds after I read Comfort and Joy. And it weirdly took me, I don't know, a quarter of the book to really remember that this was basically a prequel. I, for some reason, managed to completely forget. And that tinged everything in Comfort and Joy with, like, a whole new level of sadness and angst.
Now, Comfort and Joy is actually not that sad a book, I think.
No, it's not.
Tinged with melancholy.
Yeah. Melancholy is very good.
I read it this morning in bed with tears in my eyes, so it's fresh and vivid for me.
Well, tears in your eyes is appropriate. I think any love story ought to bring tears to your eyes.
Very true.
Agreed. I know I read Comfort and Joy years ago, and a friend of mine also owned it and read it every year for Christmas.
Yeah.
Like right around. And I was like, look, I get that it's a Christmas book, but man.
I hear from a lot of people who do that actually. It's their gay Christmas book.
It's their ritual at this point.
I used to read it every Christmas myself for a couple of years, and then I thought, well, this is kind of weird. You're reading your own book over and over again.
Isn't that the author's purview, though? I don't know any author who doesn't go back and reread their work, if only to judge themselves.
Yeah, I used to do that. The last few years, I've not really wanted to read myself anymore. I think I'll probably get over that pretty soon, though, because I would like to read Comfort and Joy in particular. I never read Winter Birds again. Dream Boy, I used to read pretty regularly, but it's just too hard to read in some of the passages. Nathan's just such an embattled kid.
Yeah, I can't actually remember the last time I reread Dream Boy because I have to be in the right mindset for it. It was probably a couple years ago. Well, it was published in at least in the U.S. in what, like 1995, so it's had a long shelf life in people's imaginations.
Yeah. And I still get email about it. And the most common email I get is, what the heck is going on with the ending?
That actually dovetails so nicely into one of our topics, which is basically ambiguous endings. and tragic endings, which I guess is kind of a spoiler in itself. And I was going to say, because I've heard people argue that the end of Dream Boy isn't tragic, but the rest of the book is so tragic anyway, that I don't think you can argue yourself out of that corner. The general you, not you. You.
Right, right.
It's pretty, it's a bummer. I have to say, it's a bummer.
Yeah, yeah. He's murdered, he's resurrected, and they go away to a spirit world. That's the best description I can give to it. I mean, no, I don't think it's a, I think it's a tragic ending. What I would think of, I think it's got a grace note of happiness at the end. We can think of them as together in some way.
So The Hopeless Romantic is primarily a podcast about queer romance, genre romance. But we thought it would be really cool and educational, perhaps, for our listeners to talk to someone with a history in the broader world of queer fiction, including speculative fiction, literary fiction, and stories that, unlike genre romance, don't have the same conventions of the happy ending or of the same beats. And we talk a lot about the value of those happy endings, but there's obviously something that's hugely resonant for people in stories that have very painful experiences reflected in them and not necessarily happy endings. And so we wanted to talk about kind of the value of those stories as well.
I think it's very important not to be restricted by a happy ending. That's one of the reasons, you know, I was actually quite drawn to the idea of writing gay romance at one point, but then every time I would, you know, I'd always get to a certain point in the story and feel that twist coming on and feel my darker side taking over the story, especially given the history that most gay people grow up with and carry into adulthood. I think it's really valid to create pieces of fiction that tap into the catharsis of being gay, to tap into the way that the world can fuck with you if you're in love with somebody or not, but especially in terms of the way that it shapes romances. I mean, a good example of this is the whole conception of comfort and joy. At the time that I wrote that book, I could not think of a single gay couple, a single novel where there was a gay couple that survived from beginning to end. You know, there still aren't that many. The obsession that especially early gay writing had was to write about promiscuity or to write about gay relationships that end, and especially that end in a hard way. So I wanted to write something that was a little bit different. Even though it's not an entirely happy book, it does have the value of keeping that couple together.
And I'm so glad, since I would have cried more if they had broken up.
There was no way I was going to let those guys break up. I mean, Danny's kind of an alter ego. So I took his, the comfort and joy was the place where I took his life in a different direction than mine went. I became a solitary kind of writer, and he married a doctor, which I thought was, you know, kind of cool. I still get people asking me if I'm ever going to write a sequel to that book. And I have thought, for a long time, I thought, no, I really didn't have anything else to say. But after gay marriage became legal, I thought, well, you know, it would be really interesting to deal with how Danny and Ford take in this idea that now they can be a married couple.
That sounds like something I'd also cry over.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like it would be similarly brutal. But, you know, it's funny. Immediately in that story, like Austin said, it has sort of a melancholic tinge or a tinge of the melancholy. And having read your other work, I wasn't quite sure how the book was going to end. And I was so pleased and so relieved that both of those characters got to where they got to. In my little, you know, reader way, I wish the best for them. So if you ever did do a sequel that was about them in this point in time after a gay marriage was legalized, that would be really cool.
I would only do it if I could figure out a way to keep them together and yet still keep drama in the book. Because it's not just instinct, it's sort of a will thing. I just don't want that couple to end. I suspect they have to survive infidelity on the part of one of them or the other or something like that, because that's a fairly common thing to have to deal with.
I think one of the things that can be... it's not as often addressed, I think, especially in queer romance, as I would love to see, is the development of a relationship post the getting together. One of the things I really enjoyed about Comfort and Joy is that although it is, they do come to a getting together sort of place, there it also works through so many stages of their relationship. It doesn't end when Ford finally asks Danny out to dinner, because the conflict runs so much deeper than that. And I think that that was really neat to see. I had not seen that in such detail in a book in a long time.
Yeah.
I was very proud of that. I really wanted to write about the fight that they had to have a relationship at all. And especially with Danny's past, but also Ford's past in its own way isn't a terribly happy one. It seems like it ought to be, but he's been so roped in by his parents and his family that it takes him along. The interesting to me was that the struggle was so much centered on him and what he was going to do. I thought that's one of my favorite things that I've written, frankly, is Ford's journey toward coming out. I've written a couple of gay romance-oriented books that I wasn't able to get published, though, oddly, because Algonquin thought, I had a falling out with Algonquin a few years back. I've patched it up with him since. I submitted a novel about two gay guys in college, and their response to it was that it was too gay, which was really upsetting. And I'm going back to that book now and looking at it again. And there was a mood that changed in publishing. In the 90s, there was a very friendly attitude towards gay writing on the part of non-gay publishers. Then after that, that trend passed and they moved on to other trends, which is what, mainstream publishing does. It moves from one trend to another. They wouldn't really consider that book. And it kind of broke my heart because I really loved it.
That's so interesting to hear. I actually wanted to ask you about sort of the publishing climate in the 90s and earlier versus now.
I've always resisted going with niche publishers, a publisher that aims itself exclusively at gay writing and gay audiences. Not so much out of snobbery as because I want to get books recognized and I don't want to be, I'm already labeled enough in terms of being a Southern writer and a gay writer. So that to publish with a press that aims itself purely at a gay audience felt like being defeated. I'm having to rethink that now, though, because if I really want to publish that book before I'm too old to enjoy it, I may have to turn to one of the smaller independent gay presses to get it done. It just makes me angry. I'm sure the Algonquin people aren't ever going to hear this, but it makes me angry that I can't really get them to see that that's a valid book.
We were talking about how there's a real struggle between where do you get books shelved and how do you get books out to a larger audience while still, of course, keeping them accessible to a core readership. But they're really torn, wanting their mysteries to be shelved with mysteries and science fiction to be shelved with science fiction. And at the same time trying to keep it accessible to readers. But that there's a real struggle when anything that includes, say, gay characters gets thrown into the gay and lesbian section.
You're already fighting that. And so if you yourself capitulate to it as a publisher or as a writer, it's like you're climbing into the box. They should have to put you in the box. You shouldn't put yourself in it.
It should be strategic marketing, not something that you've already resigned yourself to.
Right, right. And I think for all its progressive attitude, publishing is really a pretty conservative industry.
Yeah.
They talk a good game, but they're all about, I get the feeling that in some ways gay writers are being left behind again or not being considered again or being shunted off into that. It's not that you can't look at the top end because there's always big successes. It's the big body of gay work that it seems to me doesn't really get the attention that it ought to get.
It's interesting to me, though, because while there are constraints with going with like a really queer-friendly press or a niche queer press, there is a value to that in my mind because we at least get to curate our own literary community, whereas it's a little bit more hit and miss in a big five or a general press.
I totally agree, and I read those books. I like, I just always, though, when you spend 2 or 3 years writing a book, you want to give it to a press that has a real shot at getting a Times review. It may just be vanity, but it's it sounds terrible to talk about that stuff, but you do have to think about feeding your career if you're going to hang around. But I think I probably have to get over myself. And since I haven't been able to place that book in particular with the presses that I went to first, I need to just keep trying to get it published and take what I can get with it. Readers, ultimately, it's getting people to read it that you want to, that's what you want to have happen. And I'm perfectly willing for that to happen wherever it can.
Maybe if you framed it as like your own experiment in publishing, okay, this book didn't sell to the first consideration publishers. Maybe I can try something a little outside the box. Because if you're making that shift deliberately, maybe it won't feel quite so constraining.
I agree.
It is a bummer, though, because I try so hard to, for example, I'm the LGBT director at a boutique press called Alternating Current, and one of the things I'm in charge of is finding people to talk about queer literature and queer experiences in literature. And unfortunately, most of that is either a university press published something, somebody wrote a memoir, occasionally there's a piece of literary or spec, but a lot of it is romance focused, and I love queer romance. It's where I, you know, that's my bread and butter, but you can't write 10 blog posts, 10 interviews about the same subject over and over. And it was just kind of depressing, a little demoralizing how small really the availability of work that isn't romance is in the current market. I hope that changes. I hope it opens back up. I hope more publishers take risks. And I said risks in air quotes. It's not a risk.
I think it points to, unfortunately, you know, the bulk of it being published is queer romance, and yet queer romance is not considered worthy of mainstream attention.
Yeah, that too.
And so it's a sort of double bind.
Well, romance in general isn't deemed worthy of literary attention, and that I think is a mistake. There's some really fine writing in the romance arena. So I think there's so much snobbery in the publishing world, and it comes at you from so many different angles. I mean, I had to, Comfort and Joy was rejected by Algonquin probably, I think, 3 times before I finally just put my foot down and said, no, you've really just got to publish this, or I'm going to take it somewhere else. I had that book, I worked and worked on that book. They wanted rewrite after rewrite of it and just kept telling me, no, this is not a book that you should publish. I think what they wanted to say was, this is too gay, we're not comfortable with it. But they finally did get comfortable with it and published it, and it's been one of my best books with them. It sells very steadily. I mean, it's only available as an ebook now, but that's fine with me as long as some people can get to it. So I think it's not really a new struggle. This is something that the fact that we had some positivity on the part of mainstream and larger publishers in the 90s doesn't really change the fact that they have not really understood exactly where to place gay writers, in the same way that the mainstream culture hasn't really understood how to deal with the whole gender issue. You know, we continue to be, as gay people and transgender people, the point of difference, the point of friction on so many issues. Mm-hmm. The one is the reflection of the other, clearly. The culture at large wants to accept gay people, and a lot of people think they have accepted us, but they're still not really sure what that means.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tentative. It's in many cases earnest, but it's very tentative, and it's fortunately just another thing that a lot of LGBT people get to put on their list of struggles, I suppose.
Acceptance always comes with a backlash of anger. One part of the community says yes, another part says let's pass laws about this, like the law in North Carolina. I mean, I'm sitting in North Carolina at the moment thinking, why am I, you know, I shouldn't be in here. This is where my family is. This is where I grew up. So, you know, I'm tied to this place that just passed that awful law, House Bill 2, about transgender people and what bathroom they ought. You know, it's just ridiculous when grown-up men in the legislature have to spend their time legislating who goes to the bathroom where. It's absurd.
And I think it's for me, I think the folks in North Carolina probably need the most solidarity at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're sitting over here in Seattle, and I can't imagine being trans in North Carolina at the moment.
You know, talking to people here, I can't figure out who it is who supports that law, because nobody will end up to supporting it. I've got lots of conservative relatives, and they all say they don't care. So there's some mismatch. You know, either they're just lying to me, which is likely, you know, your family lies to you. This is just a move. This is just a strategy on their part that my sister votes Republican and she tells me, well, you shouldn't take it personally. I'm not doing this to hurt you. And I'm going, well, you know, you're still part of the party that's doing these things and mm-hmm. putting out all this information about me. And I don't know how you think I can't take that personally. But how did we get on politics? That's my fault.
Talking about especially those really uncomfortable family dynamics, something that really touched me about Comfort and Joy was how much maybe empathy, I don't know if empathy is the right word, but how human and fully realized the characters who were definitely being terrible to Danny and Ford in that book were, especially Ford's family. They came off to me as very real people who were clearly struggling in a way that a lot of times I see that type of homophobia kind of...
cartoonish.
Yeah. Very kind of just blown up and cartoonish and not dealt with as another kind of human pain that might be causing a tremendous amount of pain. But I really appreciated that.
It's so easy to say that homophobes are just stupid or just narrow-minded. But the fact is, they are afraid, and it's a genuine fear. It comes from something larger than they can control. It's not as simple as they hate us, because in my experience, they don't, but they feel some deep discomfort that I do have empathy for. I don't. Mm-hmm. I wish I could make it go away. I don't think you can do anything about I don't think you make a difference in terms of talking to people about their homophobia if you start off the conversation by saying, well, I know you're just stupid and that's why you have these attitudes about gay people, because that's,
yeah,
you know, that's not going to help anything.
Shut down a conversation 101.
Right. I mean, that's the internet's done so much of that to us. I think the comment board style conversations that we have with one another through Twitter and through comment boards and through Facebook. I mean, we read this meme that starts going around and everybody says, oh, you know, those homophobes, let's just hang them and kill them all. And I'm going, well, yeah. If that's our response, if we can't be better than that, they're not going to be better than that ever. I really wanted Ford's family to feel human. I mean, I want everybody I write to feel human, even the worst people that I write about. And Winter Birds comes to mind in terms of writing about Danny's father. I wanted you to feel him, at least, to feel the kind of pain he's going through, so that you don't just see him as a monster. And the character in Comfort and Joy, his mother was a very cold person, but she loved her husband and she saw how afraid he was of his son turning out to be gay. And that was the moment I think that humanized both those people for me.
Yeah, and I hate to give spoilers because now I want everyone to read Comfort and Joy, but since it's fresh on my mind, the moments at the end with Ford's family where you really see them kind of falling apart in themselves, and you see how this fear and this hatred that they possess is turning on themselves as well. You know, his mother is in tears. She's clearly actually upset. She's not this cartoonish villain. It's very powerful because I think in many ways that's a much more healing way. It's sometimes maybe a more difficult way to look at those people in our lives.
It lets you know that there's a possible future, not necessarily complete acceptance, but at least a detente.
Mm-hmm.
You can see them. You can see that they're not going to shut their son out completely. And I think that's important. That's one of the reasons I think the idea of going back to those people and writing about them again is intriguing, to see exactly where they did end up. that would be a dangerous thing to do also, because in some ways it's better to imply something than actually just say what happened.
For sure. We talked about that. One of our faves, our fave romance authors is K.J. Charles, and our favorite book by her is, I think it's Think of England, and everyone loves Think of England, and everyone's clamoring for a sequel, and the long and short of it is, like, I would love to write a sequel, but it would have to be so compelling that I have to write it, and it couldn't be... Stories are often better in readers' heads, and you don't want to shatter the perfect idea, the perfect epilogue, the perfect sequel they already had in their head.
Right.
So unless it's an incredibly driving story, sometimes it's best to leave it alone and let the audience, you know, make up their own ambiguous ending.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's kind of the Star Wars syndrome. It would be better if a lot of those prequels had never come to be. The Star Wars in everyone's mind was far better than the Star Wars that they actually produced.
It's entirely true.
I was just going to say, it's hard to live up to the kind of the dreamy ideations of somebody who watched Star Wars as a child and for whom, like, it was magic when it's, you know, 30 years later, prequels, and the CGI is really bad.
I used to get a lot of email from people who read Dream Boy to say, are you going to write, you really have to tell us what happened next. Can't you, you're going to have to write a sequel to that book. And I kept saying, they're post-dead. How exactly?
Ghostly adventures.
What do you think I could do next?
What do you want?
Just a lot of scenes with a lot of very vague writing that
right.
It resembles astral projection.
They're in the phantom zone.
Even though I'm joking about that, I'd read it. It wouldn't destroy the first one.
Well, I have thought about including them in a peripheral way in a fantasy novel, in a fantasy world, and saying, well, that's where they ended up. You know, there are those woodcutters in that fable that I wrote about X. So I might play with something like that one day, just so I can say, well, I did write a sequel, and there it is, and you can read it, and make of it what you will.
No, I like that idea, because then you'd get to show a more traditional happy ending, and you wouldn't be a complete rehash, so I'm into that.
And I'll let you know when I do.
We touched on this a little bit in terms of the publishing culture in the 90s. One of the questions I had, because a lot of these books are so, and I keep saying melancholic, but they are, they're variously tragic and melancholic. And with the exception of Boulevard, which in my mind is very much a, and I hate to say this about 1978, but a period piece.
Yeah. I think it is a picaresque kind of book.
But my question really is, if you were to write, let's say that wasn't your backlist, right? If you were to write those stories now, would they be significantly different? Is the culture of the world we live in and the sort of publishing world different enough to change them in some way?
I would have to grow up now, I think, to answer that question. I've just turned 60, so if I'd been born in the 90s, I think, yeah, those books would be significantly different, especially if I hadn't grown up in such hard circumstances. I mean, people tell me all the time, you know, you're the saddest writer, you write the most depressing books. And, you know, that's kind of a hard baggage to have, because in fact, when I first started, for instance, with Winter Birds, all I was doing was writing the story of my childhood. That is basically an autobiographical novel. That it's not an autobiography, but that's the way I lived up until I went to college in a family with that kind of battle going on. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think much of it until I started showing pieces of the book to people, and they started looking at me going, oh my God, what is this book? You know, who could live through this? I can barely live through reading it. And I'm going, well, you know, sorry.
You're like, I'm sorry, your secondhand experience of my life is traumatic for you.
Right. I would like to say, yeah, the books would be different now. I do know that if I could get back to writing, the books that I am writing are significantly different. I'm writing a book now about, it's a historical novel, but it's about a woman who becomes the owner of several houses of prostitution in New Orleans during the Civil War. And she's evolving to be a lesbian or someone with a very open sexuality as I write the book. And it is, in fact, but it's got some passages in it that are just as dark as anything I've written before. I think that's just me. And maybe that's the most honest answer, is that that's just me, and I can't get rid of that. I might have had a bestseller if I could have written happier stuff. That's my one regret, is that I've never had that kind of book that reached everybody. And I think every writer dreams of that. But given the subjects that I've taken on, I don't think there was any way that was going to happen.
Well, no, and I think it made it poignant for a lot of your readers who, I know you must have had a whole glut of straight or straight identifying readers for Dream Boy and Comfort and Joy. And I think My Drowning would have had primarily straight readers as well. The queer people I know who read those books were touched by them in a way that I don't think, I feel like straight people would have empathy for the characters and empathy for the circumstances, but my frequent collaborator and my best friend Macy, we were talking about Dream Boy and how formative it was, and she said, well, I read that book when I was too young to read it. Too young. I knew that I was queer, but I didn't really know what that meant, what that looked like in the world. And she was raised Mormon, so an additional layer of baggage to that. And she sort of read it and she was like, oh, this is what happens to me if I'm queer. This is the sort of thing that will happen to me if I'm queer in my life. Okay, that's cool. And she just sort of went on, you know, however long after that, a decade or more, accepting. Because that's, I think the sort of suspicion or secret pain or secret truth that a lot of LGBTQ people live with is the idea that they could have a terrible ending, that they could be tragic or alone or unaccepted or unloved in a specific way that may involve violence or may involve, you know, something that most straight people wouldn't encounter. Those of us who read it and have it be important to us, is it's super resonant. It's easy to identify that kind of, that through line. I don't know if it's like the universal queer experience. Can you imagine? The universal queer experience is just agony.
I hope that's not true for kids coming along now. I think there's a chance that it's not.
I think it's a lot better now. She and I are sort of on the cusp of millennials who maybe grew up before there was quite the surge of political and cultural acceptance. I don't know. It's still not there, but we're sort of, I would say, I don't want to say this definitively, but I think we're in the age range of people who would have maybe felt that immediate knee-jerk instinctive reaction. Oh, this is what will happen to me if I'm queer. And my hope is that people who are younger than I am, the generations coming up now, don't have that knee-jerk suspicion or pain that they're carrying around.
One of the things that to me remains really important about these stories, though, is I think even though generations that are probably even younger than me, I'm 22, so I'm younger than Amanda. Growing up, like, Brokeback Mountain was kind of the definitive gay media, which doesn't promise
a
whole lot of great
story
things.
That is, yes.
Yeah, it's great. I think that while especially the youngest generations that are coming out are going to have a very, thankfully, different experience in the world, that energy is still very much in the world. And I think that that has shifted. But of course, there are so many people for whom those experiences are resonant, which is why I get frustrated. I love happy endings, but I do get frustrated when people say they are, you know, they're done with books that are about homophobia, or they're done with books that are about transphobia or tragedy. Because I do want there to be other stories, but I'm still dealing with all that. I still want to see that reflected in literature.
We did talk about in our villains and anti-heroes episode, the idea that cartoonish homophobia, cartoonish transphobia, cartoonish portrayals of something that is complex is maybe more what we're tired of. And I mean, anything that doesn't have depth to it is going to ring like that, but specifically so many books through sort of the queer canon have had portrayals of homophobia that may ring, I don't know, out of date or tired because of the way that things have shifted.
Well, we have to pay attention to the fact that things can move backwards. They often do. The way that the women's movement has evolved over the last couple of centuries is pretty clear evidence of that. I mean, women take a step forward and then get shoved back again and then take a step forward and get shoved back again. I mean, it's a, and I hope, and we also have to be aware that we're, when we say things are better, we're really talking about in Western countries, because there's so many countries beyond the West where, you know, the language of acceptance of gay people isn't there yet. I'm very aware of that because I teach so many students from abroad in my, I teach writing at Emory University in Atlanta, and we have an extremely international student body, and a lot of the gay kids I deal with come from places where it's just, it's horrifying what they go through if they try to come out. In fact, I had a student years ago whose best friend came out as gay and ended up killing himself because of his family's reaction. His family was so virulent about, and his family wouldn't even let friends attend his funeral because of the fact that he had come out as a gay person. I mean, things are better, but they're not better everywhere, and they don't have to stay better. So we have to be very careful about that.
And it's too easy to buy into that sort of that general progress narrative where it's like, and well, now we have gay marriage literally everywhere, and we will never move backwards from that point.
Well, it's like for years the sort of ideal was, well, if you come from a small town where people are violently homophobic or extremely conservative and you don't know any other queer people, all you have to do is just move to a big city. Big cities are still conservative and homophobic, and not everyone has the money and means to move, and not everyone wants to leave their roots behind. Maybe we can focus on, I don't know, improving the communities that small town people live in. Maybe we can do that instead of just expecting everyone to move to LA and New York. That's a thing.
Well, maybe the message really ought not to be that it gets better, but that you get stronger, because it doesn't necessarily get better. It is horrifying. What I guess we've gone from thinking things are better to thinking that they're just the same.
They're better in certain respects. They're better in terms of certain protections for certain people. It's just an odd thing to have to qualify that so much, because I feel I'm fairly privileged. I'm a white middle or working class cis woman who, I have a lot going for me, and my privilege is pretty decent, but it would be a completely different story if I didn't live in America, or if I was differently abled, or the list goes on of like ways that my life could be so much harder. I feel pretty safe, but I don't feel 100% safe by any means.
Being white and gay and enjoying privilege on the one side of yourself and something that's not privilege on the other side of yourself gives you a taste of two very different sides of the world, especially if you're aware of it and if you try to examine it. I think that's one thing we can bring as gay people, as transgender people, to what we write, to the stories that we tell, even to the stories with happy endings. I mean, you can write a happy ending. That doesn't mean the whole... A happy ending is a way of finishing a book. It doesn't mean that the whole book was happy. I still think Comfort and Joy has a happy ending. It's not a happy journey all the way through. And I wouldn't call it a romance novel, but to me, it's the realest book that I've written, because it does write about a completely human struggle that ends up in the light rather than in the dark. It's easily my favorite of my books. I don't think it's the best of my books, but it's the one that I think gives people something that I really hope helps them.
I was going to say, when we emailed you or reached out to you to be on the podcast, I had read most of your books, and Austin hadn't. Austin is, I think, right in the age range where he wouldn't have gone out and found Dream Boy the way that I did. And so I was like, oh, I'll lend you some Jim Grimsley. Well, if we're going to be talking about romance, we might, in any capacity, I might not want to hand you Boulevard. I might not want to hand you Winter Birds. How about Comfort and Joy and Dream Boy? I'll just give you those. And he was reading... Comfort and Joy, and I was like, I promise it has a happy ending.
at a certain point, somewhere in the middle, I was like, ouch.
Yeah, I think I asked you what your progress was or something, and you were like, this book is not cheerful.
With that said, it was very cathartic, and definitely reading it with tears in my eyes was a good thing. All through, for all the different reasons.
It is a hard story, but you never get the feeling that they're those two men just love each other so much. It hurts. Mm-hmm. But I think the strongest loves that I have felt have had that resonance to them. It's sometimes loving somebody is the most unbearable feeling of all. You feel mm-hmm. so exposed. You feel all your nerve endings. It's never been an experience for me that just had violin music in the background. It's a very harrowing thing to open yourself up to somebody like that.
I think in the case of Ford and Danny, they're both so similarly, not really similar, but they're both kind of damaged and they're both kind of internal and they're both fairly wary people. And it's amazing, especially for Danny, that as with his baggage, that he can still trust Ford enough to let him in. And that to me is the mark of like a really good romance when people are making a conscious, like it isn't, you know, love at first sight. There's minimal negotiation and conflict working through and everything falls by the wayside. Because to me, the stories that have the most impact in terms of romance are ones where there are conscious, deliberate decisions to open yourself up to another person and to keep the relationship going.
Yeah. Well said. I love that.
Yeah, well, some of the moments in Comfort and Joy where you have a relationship that is clearly intense and filled with love, and yet that alone doesn't make it work. It's those moments when they consciously, you know, sit down and are able to articulate what they need out of it to keep it moving forward and deepening. It's really powerful.
Yeah, and they're both fairly reticent people. I mean, they're not, I don't think either of them would be on a podcast about romance.
Neither of them are sitting out there being like, okay, Danny, reasonably speaking, these are all the things that I'm uncomfortable with. And
they're not going to do couples therapy now.
I was just going to say, I was like, they are not a good candidate for that. So you mentioned earlier that Winterbirds was in many ways an extremely autobiographical work. And when I was doing the cursory research on you, that was one of the things I saw in an interview that you did. I know that the memoir that you published in 2015 is, but it's interesting to me to see how much of your early work draws on autobiography. That is a not easy word to say.
Sometimes.
It draws on a lot of autobiographical elements. And was that something that happened organically, or did you sit down and be like, okay, well, I'm going to write Winterbirds with Danny as a proxy? Or was it, oh, I'm writing this story and suddenly it starts to look a lot like things that I went through?
It's more the former than the latter. When I was studying writing in college, one of the things my writing teachers told me was the first books you write are probably going to be stories of your own life, because that's the only thing you really know that's worth talking about. And I, you know, I also did a lot of study of the Bildungsroman tradition, the novel about the adolescent going through adolescence. And so that's really what I set out to write. In my case, though, because of the trauma that I could remember from my childhood, the more I touched on that, the more powerful the piece of fiction felt and the more good it did me as a writer. And so I think that's where that direction, that's why I got led in that direction so completely. Then once I created Danny in Winterbirds, I was drawn to the notion of using him again and taking his life. You know, what was it like to live with the trauma he'd been through as a child 20 or 30 years later? How was he coping with it in his late 20s and 30s? How did he grow out of it? What did it affect? How did it affect his relationships? By the time I'm writing Comfort and Joy, I wouldn't call that autobiographical. It's still true that Danny's very similar to me, but I'm not writing Danny as a surrogate for me in the same way that I did in Winterbirds. So it was a process of evolution, but it was a deliberate process at the beginning to mine my own life for this stuff. It took me a long time to have the confidence to write about things that I didn't know about directly, because I'm very strongly prefer to write fiction that people feel really deeply. You know, not mm-hmm. every writer is that interested in that, but I want you to be able to track the character's emotions moment by moment and to feel them. That's one of the reasons, that's one of the places it was interesting to hear you talk about the reticence of those two characters. Because one of my theories about writing is that it's the silence that happens between two people that really tells you who they are. You know, if people start to express themselves too directly, then what you've got is something that you don't trust anymore. Whereas when people are communicating really deeply and you understand what is going on when they're not talking to each other, that's when you really begin to understand them and to feel them. And in order to recreate that, I had to write about things that I knew and had lived through really directly. Be taking my writing into a different territory. And so now I'm trying to write about things that are farther away from me, including branching out into fantasy and science fiction, and now into a novel that's basically an historical.
I'm really interested in that one, by the way. That sounds like it is 150% up my alley.
I hope so. I really want this book to. I wanted to have a lot of things that I haven't been able to achieve in books before. A kind of a drama and scale. And it's based on a story by George Washington Cable, but I'm moving very far afield from what he wrote. But she's fascinating to me. It is really interesting to me.
Yeah, I'm psyched for that one. I was actually, one of my questions was what you're working on now, because I know that you teach and I know that your last couple of things that were published were the memoir and then fiction novels you published were in like 2006. And then you had the collection of short stories and stuff. So I kind of wondered where your creativity is at. Are you working primarily on fiction? Are you working on plays? What's your day-to-day like now?
I just finished a play. It's the first new play I've written in several years. I've been writing a lot of short stories. Not a lot. I mean, oddly enough, it takes me much more work to write a short story than it does to write a novel, because the focus is so intense. That period mm-hmm. between 2006 and 2015, that's the years when I wrote the couple of gay novels that I couldn't get anybody to pay any attention to.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's not that I took a hiatus. It's that I just couldn't. Publishing went through a convulsion, and publishing was very... Publishers, even if you put the gay issue aside, publishers had to rethink who they were going to get behind and who they were not going to get behind. And I think I was on the cusp of getting left behind for a while there. The big convulsion that happened in publishing around the turn of the millennium, when electronic books came along, meant that they had to rethink their attitude toward the midlist. And I've always been a midlist author. For a while, talking about that kind of stuff was painful, but it's, you know, reality is reality. If you don't sell hundreds of thousands of books, you don't have the clout that's going to carry you through the kind of transition that publishing has gone through now. I think the millennial transformation was bigger than people thought it was going to be. I think it's what the coming of ebooks and the changes that went through publishing because of electronic media and the competition from electronic media was similar to that transition from silent films to talkies. Some actors made the transition and some didn't. And it's been difficult for writers to get across that divide. I know a lot of my friends have gone through the same thing, straight and gay. It's difficult for me to look at that gap and think, you know, I went 9 years without a book because I had published so frequently before that. But now I have made the leap and I hope I can continue to publish until I drop dead.
Well, I hope so too. I think we have exhausted our list of burning questions. Yes.
Well, I think I covered everything I want to. We didn't actually talk about the movie of Dream Boy. Have either of you guys ever seen?
I've seen it, yeah. Yeah, I saw it. I remember finding out, I was on like, This is going to date me, but I was on like a LiveJournal community called Oh No They Didn't, which was a community about like pop culture news. And some enterprising soul had posted like, there's going to be a movie adaptation of Dream Boy. And immediately like me, my ex-girlfriend, my best friend at the time were just like, it's time. It's time. That was actually a weirdly faithful adaptation. It was surreal in many ways because I didn't really know what to expect from the tone. And that is a great segue into asking what it is like to have your work adapted like that. Because I know that you know, you're a playwright. So obviously you see people expressing your work and sort of making their transformative changes to it. But an adaptation into film is so different.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of movies in general. I don't watch a lot of them. I just like books so much that it doesn't leave a lot of room. You know, so many movies are just so cringeworthy, frankly. I'll sit down to watch a movie on a DVD or on one of the cable channels, and something in it will strike me as stupid, and I'll just turn it off and go do something that I want to do. I was really thrilled when somebody decided to make a movie of that book. And surprised at how long it took and what a fight it was for him to get the funding to do it. And then when I actually, you know, I didn't have anything to do with the adaptation. He never did show it to me. And I didn't really want to see it because I didn't want to hate it before it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to get myself involved in it because you don't have, you know, you can read it and hate it and comment about it, but you can't change it. That's the way movies work. He had complete authority over what he did with the story, but I trusted him, and that's why I gave him the book in the first place. And I thought, well, you know, you just have to live with that decision. So I went out, and you know, I'm in the movie for just a brief cameo. So I was on set watching him film it, and I just got a really good feeling about what he was doing because it felt right. You know, it was... Unfortunately, the movie didn't make much of an impact, but when I watch it, I feel very proud of it because I think they did, especially given the tiny budget that they were working with, he did a good job of transferring that book to the page. I differ with the ending that he put on it.
Yeah, that was, I think that was always going to be a difficult thing to adapt because it's so, I don't think it's a super literal ending.
No, it's not. And he, what he explained to me, this was something we talked about before it was ever filmed, that, you know, you can't film the ending that you wrote, that he said, I can't film the ending that you wrote. So I'm going to have to interpret the ending and you're just going to have to deal with that because what you wrote really, it's too dreamy. There's no way to make it. That works in prose, but it won't work on film.
Yeah. Some stuff just isn't cinematic.
Right. I think you could have come closer to the dreaminess of the written ending, but you would have needed a much bigger budget than he had.
For sure.
What he did was in keeping with the spirit of the ending, I think. It's similarly vague.
Yes, so long as there's some vagueness there, I think that we're at least in the same zip code. Yeah, that was, I so vividly remember hearing about it and then finally getting my hands on a copy, which took, it seems like forever. I think I had to buy it from the distributors. I don't remember what. I don't remember under what circumstances I watched it, but I do very vividly remember watching it. And it was kind of a weird thing because, I mean, I was young when I read Dream Boy. I wasn't as young as my friend was, but I was, you know, a queer teenager on the younger end of teenage, like 14. That one stuck with me, and I read it over and over again through the years. To see something that personal adapted, because, you know, people love Lord of the Rings, and so they love the Lord of the Rings adaptations, but that's more of a no-brainer. Like, obviously, something that massive and epic would be adapted, but never in my wildest dreams, no pun intended, did I assume that Dream Boy was going to get an adaptation, indie or not. So that was, I don't know, it was like validating that this, as a reader and then at one point a viewer, that the book resonated with enough people to be seen in this whole new medium.
I have heard from some of the fans of the book that they didn't, when people don't like the movie, it's because they don't like the way Roy was cast because he's not their image of what Roy ought to be.
Oh yeah.
He's a great actor, but he's, you know, he's not described the way Roy is described in the book. So that's the only sticking point I think that people had. Most of the fans of the book, though, went with the movie when they finally were able to see it.
I mean, I had a moment, I think I saw stills before I saw the movie, and I was like, oh, okay, they went with that. So yeah, I really liked the adaptation. It wasn't perfect, but it was definitely, it definitely evoked a lot of the same tone that I got from the novel, and I didn't mind the ending.
Same here. Well, that pretty much covers, that covers basically what I wanted to, I did want to talk about the movie just a little bit.
It's for posterity.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us, Jim, and thank you for the really great conversation and for making us cry so much.
I certainly hope I have. I hope it's not the last time I've made you cry, Austin.
I love how borderline ominous that was.
Like, nervously opens Dream Boy.
It's like sort of specter just lurking.
All right, so that's it for this episode. As always, if you would like to continue the conversation with us on Twitter, I am at Austin Chanted.
I am at Amanda H. Jean.
And I am at Jim Grimsley 1.
All right, thanks so much, folks. See you next time.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Dario DeFour, with graphics by Keezy Young and music composed by Carly Ann Warden. Follow us on Twitter at @VHRPodcast, add us on Facebook, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.
We really did enjoy and appreciate having Jim Grimsley on the podcast, and I figured as a little bit of bonus content, I would play everybody the supercut of voicemail messages that my best friend and frequent collaborator Macy sent me upon realizing that I had told other people Jim Grimsley was going to be on the podcast, but I hadn't told her, and she's as big of a fan as I am, if not bigger, so I hope everyone enjoys the harassing voicemail messages I received.
You are fucking up. You are deliberately fucking up right now. Every time that I have fucked up just became null. Because you are fucking up right now. Because you didn't tell me that Jim Grimsley is going to be in your fucking podcast. I don't have words right now. I want to take the entirety of Dream Boy and, like, drown you in it. Slowly smother your face with the pages. I don't have words. I have ceased to words. Amber told me. I can't. You need to check yourself. Nothing out of it. Oh, yeah, we're eating fucking block at Avila's with margaritas, and you're not here because you didn't tell me about Jim Grimsley. So remember that time that the Entertainment Weekly cover came out and you lost it and I wasn't there? Nope, doesn't matter anymore. And remember that time that the Civil War trailer came out and it wasn't there? Nope, it doesn't matter. Did our Dream Boy experience mean nothing? I still don't have words for this. Moment of silence. Fucking wrote Dream Boy. Do you know how old I was when I read Dream Boy? I was 8 years old. Maybe 9. Do you know what that ending did to me? It gave me feelings. It gave me feelings, Amanda. Remember when the fucking movie came out and your fucking ex-girlfriend posted about it? Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. Because we talked about it. Because we talk about Jim Grimsley. Except for the one critical time which he has come into your life and you have not told me about it. Who are you? Who am I? Why am there? But some days, why? And you were fucking up. You were deliberately fucking up. Jim Grimsley. Fucking Dream Boy. Dream Boy. Dream Boy was one of the first LGBT novels I ever read. Okay, I'm done. I'm done. I'm so done. Jim Grimsley.